Welcome back to Art Smack. I'm Annie Taylor, and I'm here with my co-host,
Sherry Gagosian.
And we're joined today with Bianca Bosker, who's here to talk about her amazing book called Get the Picture. Welcome, Bianca.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
We loved your book.
Yep.
Where did I hear about your book? Did you tell me about your book? No. I read about your book. And I was like, who is this little bitch who also letting all the art world secrets out? I must know her. And I read the book and I loved it. And I loved that as a writer, you get to name the names.
Yes.
Was that hard in the art world to even allow people, get people who would even allow you to write about them?
Yeah. I mean, getting access was incredibly difficult. It nearly killed me. It was surprising. Like, perhaps it was naive, but I think that there was a part of me that thought that, like, you know, people would welcome me with open arms. I don't know. Like, there was this, I had this sense of the art world as being incredibly open and exciting about sharing what they were doing. I know, just nodding like, what a poor lost lamb.
Let's take her under our wing. Yeah.
And I just thought, okay, people will be so excited to share what they're doing. Like, they just, you know, believe in the more the merrier. Like, we have to embrace as many people as possible in the warm hug of art. And instead, you know, as I write about it, I ended up feeling like an FBI agent trying to get into the mob.
And, 100%.
You know, people didn't want to talk, didn't want to even answer very basic questions around, like, how do you do art? And, you know, I had people telling me, like, because I had this goal of not just interviewing people, but also immersing myself in the art world, going and working in there, really understanding, like, how do things work? And I remember telling people who knew much more about art than I did that this was my plan. And their advice ranged from, that's impossible, to, that's a terrible idea if you want to keep living in New York.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. I was thinking before you came about, like, ways that I could joke with you, but also attack you about your book. And the only one that I came up with, and I have to write it down because I'm not even going to be able to say this with a straight face, okay. But it was,
I'm ready.
Welcome back to Art Smack. Bianca, congratulations on your book, Get the Picture. Bianca, my culture is not your costume.
Right.
Wait, did I write anything else mean? Oh, no, that was kind of it. But I was like, I was laughing so much because I, first of all, the art world is a club that doesn't want to be found out. Like, it likes to float on a certain level. It loves to talk about things like inclusivity and openness and progressiveness.
And community.
And community. Mm-hmm. But it is the most conservative, patriarchal,
Uptight.
Dare I say waspy? You're sounding like my family right now. environment.
Well, I was really struck just recently. There was someone that just became the new head of a museum, and she was basically like, you know, we want to make it more inclusive and welcome more people in. And even in saying that statement, she used the most absurd art speak you can imagine. It was we need to, like, question the liminal space and the dichotomies between the hierarchies of the people we're letting in. And I was like, this doesn't feel like the way to begin, first of all. It's a noble goal, one that I applaud, but, like, listen to how you're describing this goal.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that I was lucky enough to eventually find people who were excited about, like, getting more people excited about art.
Yeah.
Who believed, as I put it, like, we want to see more people love it. We believe this industry needs to open up to survive. And they were my guides. They were generous. They brought me in. They explained how it worked. As Elizabeth Denny, who I worked for, she was like, I want people to see what a shit show this business is.
Yeah.
And I think that that is important at all levels. I think it's important for collectors to understand the struggle. I think it's important for gallerists to be honest with each other about what they're going through. I think it's important, you know, for the layperson to understand what artists and galleries are up against. And obviously it's important for artists to understand how this chosen world of theirs really works. And I was really, I guess, like, disheartened in a lot of the conversations I had with artists by how little they even understood the mechanics of it. You know, like, we would sit down and, you know, they had so much more at stake than I did, had so much more experience in this world. And I'd be like, how do you get a show? And they're like, I've spent 12 years trying to answer that question.
Yeah. Then when they have that first show, the paintings are going to be $30,000 each if it ever comes, mainly because they have to pay for all that debt that they've incurred getting to that moment.
Yeah, it's wild. And I think that that was the other piece of it for me is I really quickly figured out that I wanted to focus on like the emerging side, the up and coming side. Like I think that's the highest stakes and least covered part of this world. Mm-hmm. And also the big prices, the big names are to me not, of course they exist. And of course it's a big part of this, but that's not most people's experience. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I also feel like the emerging galleries would probably be more welcoming to you.
You would have thought. You would have thought. Yeah.
Yeah. So without giving too much of the book away, how did you decide like where to begin in all of this? Because, oh, sorry, because I have been projecting onto you throughout reading this entire book, I was like, okay, she and I have very similar aims. We've just gone about it very differently. And I'm like, I've done a similar thing, but I'm just like, you guys can't get mad at me. I'm an artist. I speak to Mark Spiegler, the CEO of Art Basel, and I've done pulled antics in the past. He didn't like, I'm like, my guy.
This is artistic expression.
I'm like, I conceptual. Got stoned at Art Basel in 2005, watched a movie, and thought that I was an artist in 2005 at Art Basel. This is actually your fault. You cannot be mad at me. This is art,
right,
you know?
Right.
So I was wondering,
it's okay
like,
for me to date my sculptures from 2017 tonight. Yeah. It's conceptual. Yeah, totally.
Theoretically questionable. Yeah,
definitely.
So questionable. How did you like decide? Because you'd already written a book about wine. And so you were probably in a certain echelon, right? Because I'm sure there's like a similarity of people who
I've never thought of myself as belonging to an echelon, but
people who can afford and collect wine at certain levels also tend to like to have pretty things to look at when they're sipping wine. Mm. Perhaps, I don't know. I'm also a recovering alcoholic, so I didn't really care what I looked at when I drank, but I'm sure there is some crossover in that initial subject matter, but how did you decide to go from wine to art?
I didn't think of it as like a neat transition. At the time, it just felt, they felt very separate in some ways. I think the only similarity is it began with what I can only describe as this like seismic activity in my soul, right? Like, and I think the project that became Corked Work was similar. It was like, I consider myself someone who is obsessed with obsession. Mm-hmm. And with the art world, it was a place that I had felt very alienated from. I mean, art was my passion growing up.
Yeah.
Like, I painted very seriously all through high school. I flirted with applying to art school. And then sort of like adult Bianca grabbed the wheel. And I consoled myself with this idea that, okay, if I wasn't going to make art, I would at least go and see it on a regular basis. And that lasted basically until I started trying to see art on a regular basis. And I realized, like, I felt totally out of my league. I felt like I didn't belong. I didn't know what was going on. And I just took the coward's way out. And I think I just bit by bit withdrew.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until a few years back that I felt like I might be missing out on something big. And the more I started looking into the art world, the more I was really drawn by that intense magnetism of people's passion. And I have to say, the art was still extremely confusing to me. Mm-hmm. And the people were scary and intimidating in their own way as well. It was very quickly made clear to me that, you know, I didn't dress the right way or carry myself the right way or use the right language. And at the same time, though, there was just that obsession, that need. And I think what was intriguing to me is the way that artists and also scientists describe art as this fundamental human pursuit.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, I felt like by turning my back on art, it began to feel like I was ignoring language, that I was just like giving up on a fundamental part of my humanity. And I was like, I want to figure out, why does art matter? How can any of us engage with it more deeply? And I think on a personal level, I just had this feeling that I might be doing it all wrong. Like that I needed to understand what was here because I may have misjudged something very important about my life.
And do you feel dumber or smarter coming out of the experience?
No, I'd like to think I'm smarter, of course. I mean, who wants to believe they spent 5 years, you know, 6 years of their life, whatever. Like, actually regressing.
I feel dumber. I feel like I've regressed. You know how like in art speak, by the way, they like love to always say like, this thing complicates the narrative of blah, blah, blah. Can everyone stop complicating the narrative for
Simplify
me?
Simplify it.
Like, what are you talking about? Where are we? What is the thing? I mean, I can speak art speak. Like, that's the joke. I went to art school for 7 years, but I'm like spiritually allergic to it at this point because of all the reasons that you listed off. Sometimes I'm like, the closer I come to it, I'm like, have I lost the thread? Can a fish know that it's swimming in the water?
Right. Like, I think of this book as both like a user guide to the hidden logic of the art world and also a quest to learn how to live life more expansively. Like, there was something about the way that people in the art world behaved that really intrigued me. And also, I was jealous. I mean, I think that there was this way in which, like, their reality operated according to totally different rules of nature that I was not familiar with. You know, it's like, my practice involves, like, you know, picking up pieces of my trash and examining it. And I was like, wow, like, that's either brilliant or total bullshit, but interesting and different. Mm-hmm. And I was living this like really hyper-optimized New York existence where I was like texting from the toilet while listening to podcasts on like two times speed. And like that existence felt extremely claustrophobic by comparison with this like expansive approach to life. And so I do think of this book as a love story, and like a lot of love stories, like there is agony and ecstasy along the way.
Yeah.
But I think that ultimately I'm really excited by my life now. I think it really has opened my eyes not only to seeing art differently, but to seeing the world differently. Mm-hmm. But okay, while we're on the matter of art speak, I'm very curious because I too have an art speak intolerance. Sorry,
yeah, it's been coming up.
I have a crusade.
But it's accidentally coming up like every...
I actually had a conversation about this last night while I was reading a section of my book about face-sitting and ass influencers at a very buttoned-up private club in New York City to a bunch of octogenarians who did not kick me out. but I was floating the idea of you know, some sort of a perhaps like international association to ban art speak. But, you know, perhaps we can discuss the particulars of all of that later. But, I mean, I'm just curious, like, what can be done? Like, any thoughts?
I think that we are doing the Lord's work. Okay. You have to just, like, it's like breaking a bad habit. Like,
stop.
What are you doing? Tell me. You're playing with paint. You don't know. Okay, that's it.
Dog treat. You just need like a can of like coins that you can
exactly.
Like
shake or a spray bottle.
Right.
No. Bad gallery director. No.
I mean,
that's true. I would love to see you take that to art fairs. And when someone starts talking about liminal space, you can just
like spray them.
Oh my God, I love it. Well, you know, the other thing we haven't been talking about, but it's a companion piece to art speak. So there's art speak.
Yeah.
And then the companion piece is the sob story. Mm. Because if they can't catch you with the art speak, they'll catch you with the sob story. Mm. Do you know the horrible conditions under which this person grew up?
Right.
And the life that they've had and the triumph. Do you know that they were born in a volcano?
Right.
Actually in a garbage pit in a volcano. And not only have they made it to the top of this tower in New York City, they have recreated their volcano on top of this tower as a symbol to those other people somewhere in a volcano who might need to see it.
Mm.
That they too can go to a tower one day.
But I hope that you, billionaire oligarch, buy it and put it in your storage
and
unit.
And feel so guilty and uncomfortable that you're like, I have to save this person with my money.
Mm-hmm. Right.
By buying their thing.
Right.
Because they don't need to do more charity. Mm-hmm. That they already have their tax deductions done for that. There's nothing fun in that. There's nothing to brag about in that.
Right.
But like, because you don't get to like bring that charity home with you. You don't want that homeless person who you're donating money to. You donate money.
Right.
You don't want them staying with you. But someone of that equivalence socially, you can bring home their trash and put it on their wall, call it art, tell them how much you're spending for it and that it will one day be in the MoMA.
Right.
There you go.
Right. Yes.
So
yes.
Sob story, companion to art speak.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Interesting.
Great way to catch. I know a master of this. I'll have to tell you guys off camera who it is.
Oh.
Oh. Yeah. So this person, she's incredible. She's like, she was born within the decade we were born then. Gorgeous, young, dress as well. Comes from the right family. Spends this life where her life is to nurture other artists, mm-hmm. obviously, because she doesn't need a reason to get up in the morning.
Yeah.
But she's actually very good at it. And I watch her melt these billionaire octogenarians' brains. She annihilates them. Art speaks, sob story. Wow. To the point where they're like, please take my money.
Please.
Right. Can we throw a party for this sad story that you're telling me right now? She's so good at it. Anyway.
Good for her.
Okay, I have a question for both of you. Sorry, this is weird.
Make yourself comfortable.
I'm Jim looking at the camera in the office right now. For both of you, and I'm going to shut up. I want to hear from Annie first and then from Bianca. What do you think it means to truly belong in the art world? Question one. Mm. And question two, and you have to be honest, you cannot lie or I'll be disappointed in both of you. What is the time that you ever felt the closest to that feeling?
Yeah. Hmm.
Oh my God.
You can't lie. Get on camera.
What does it mean to belong in the art world?
Yeah. What does it mean?
I think it means that you have an understanding of the world that you're seeing around you and that you can dialogue with the pieces and that you appreciate the artwork and the community behind the artist. And I think that understanding that art and understanding the people that are selling the art, representing this artist, and then having them open doors for you with a smile means that you've made it.
Okay, so say that dumber for me.
Being welcomed with open arms, with no disdain.
By who? Who do you need to be open?
Galleries, fairs, directors, a registrar.
Okay.
No. To be recognized and appreciated.
Is it better?
Oh my God, I love this Disney movie, but how
do I get there?
Is it better in this scenario to be recognized by the artists or by the handlers, aka like the gallery people, the people that sell it?
I mean, I think it depends on whether or not you're there.
For you.
For me. At this point, probably the galleries, the people representing the artist, that's more important to me because I want to support the artist, but in order to do so, I have to go through the gallery themselves. So right now, a relationship with the gallery.
Or does she? Just kidding.
Or does she? DM the artist. No, yeah. I'm kidding. I think...
She's not kidding.
I think the relationship with galleries right now is something that I'm cultivating for myself.
Thank you so much for your honest feedback.
Thank you. Okay, Bianca, yes. What hole are you digging yourself into with this response?
I'm not sure there is such a thing as belonging in the art world. I feel like that's sort of a fallacy. And the reason I say that is because when I first started like working at a gallery, it was made very clear to me over and over again what an outsider I was. Mm-hmm. And the whole thing was like, you don't know this world, you know what's going on, people aren't interested in you, you don't really have anything to add. And it's true, you know, I actually would beg to differ, but it's true that I was not like, you know, a storied art critic for Art Forum. And the sort of logic was like, as an outsider, I didn't carry currency that was of value to insiders. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that, as it was explained to me, well, people only really care about having recognitions from other insiders within the art world. Mm-hmm. And as I got further along into the art world, I sort of began to realize, like, I don't think anyone feels like an art insider.
Yeah.
Like, truly, I'm not sure anyone does. Like, I would talk with, like, the coolest gallerists in New York, and they were like, even they felt like insecure about their lack of art history knowledge, or art history PhDs were like, oh, like I'm still not sure I would really call myself an art historian. They felt like they hadn't somehow done enough to get there.
Yeah.
The other day I was in LA during Freeze and talking to this, you know, like big deal collector who was like, talking about how she felt out of place. And like even the VVVIPs that I would talk to seemed like really insecure about their status. Mm-hmm. And then artists, like fundamentally artists without whom none of this would exist,
yeah.
also are insecure about their status. They don't feel like they belong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I feel like I'm not sure anyone feels like they belong. And I think that that actually is sort of part of the twisted logic yeah. of the way that this works,
the
right?
makes you work harder. You're constantly striving for something.
Right. I mean, just look at the way everything operates, but especially art fairs, right? It's like there's always a higher tranche of like VIP uh-huh. to get to. I mean, yeah. I don't know if you've heard about the 7:30 a.m. like Basel. No, I was kidding. But like,
no, but I did just find out that the 10 a.m.s at Freeze, who go to the collector's breakfast, or the collector's breakfast that starts at 9, they get let into the fair at 10.
Mm-hmm.
And I had always thought I was the shit because I had the 11 o'clock.
We're nothing.
Nothing. I'm dirt.
That's what I'm saying. And it's like, as someone explained, like there's always someone ahead of you in line, right? Mm-hmm. And that is, I think, unfortunately, a lot of the way that people kind of gain currency and, mm-hmm. and keep power and lord it over others. And I think like that curried sense of insecurity also helps the market, right? It's like telling people that there's always something else to shoot for mm-hmm. is how you end up with, you know, people with their names on museum walls and like warehouses full yeah. of art, right? And so I guess I made a really deliberate choice in the book to try actually not to use the terms insider and outsider
okay.
because I felt like at some point that they were kind of meaningless and artificial. Like I had really yet to feel someone who felt like a genuine insider. Like everyone mm-hmm. seemed a little uncomfortable. And I think that that's on the one hand depressing and on the other hand liberating to realize because you're like, at least to me, I'd like to believe that everyone else is as sweaty at an opening as I am about whether or not I'll find anyone to talk to.
Yeah. yeah.
So over the course of your research then, you never found or encountered one person who was like, yes, I belong here. This is my thing. I'm top of the world right now.
I'm sure there are those people who project that,
yeah.
but deep down?
Yeah.
I mean, don't we feel like most of the people that project that deep down have
they're
something?
Just wildly insecure.
Like the more you insist
yeah.
on it, that the more it may not be true. Mm-hmm. But look, I can't speak for like, I haven't talked to every billionaire in the art industry.
In the New York tri-state area.
Or even most of them. So I certainly can't vouch for their experience. And, you know, would totally love to hear about how at peace and comfortable they feel in every room.
Yeah.
But really the overarching sentiment I felt for the people I encountered was like, we all feel a bit insecure
yeah.
and out of place. But I would say that the second part of your question, I think the time that I felt like most like I did belong was where I end the book, which was this experience of hanging out with the artist Julie Curtis and her husband, the artist Clinton King. Like it
hey
was
guys.
Like the heart of the and it was like the heart of the pandemic, and I was so art starved. Like it had gotten to this point where I was sheltered in place. I had like no art around me, and I was beginning to just crave it at this physical level.
Wow.
And I saw Julie and Clinton for like the first time in a while, and Clinton showed me like this video he'd been working on, and it was wild and it was incredible, and it melted my mind, and it felt like drinking, like guzzling water after a marathon, or so I imagine. I would never
yeah.
run a marathon actually. And then we went up to their roof and like drank beers and like looked at the city
yeah.
and it was just, and we talked about like philosophy and God knows what, you know, and it was just great. And but also like, mm-hmm. it wasn't about the other bullshit. It was just like this wonderful exchange of ideas that like expanded my universe
mm-hmm. yeah.
and made me see the world in this adventurous, exciting way.
I was looking for the quote the other day because I thought it was Mark Twain. And then I think the internet was telling me that it was, what is that quote? Maybe you can help me. It's like everything.
Live, love, laugh.
No, it's something like everything that says it's about sex isn't sex, and everything that and everything else is just about sex.
Interesting.
And
I don't think Mark
could be Freud, but
no, I kind of feel like it was Mark Twain. I feel like it used to be in my dad's email signature. My dad is a writer, okay, or was.
So
yeah, I'm listening to you talk, and I'm like, I wonder if art. Like, I understand the reason that it needs to be articulated in the world so that an economy, I guess, can form around it. and then more people will buy it, and artists can thrive within this thing, and you can judge a society by how sophisticated its art is, and blah, blah, blah. So I see the reason for an art world, but I wonder, when I'm listening to you talk, how much all of this articulation actually has nothing to do with the art.
What do you mean?
Like, we go around, we create reasons. Mm-hmm. Like, we throw parties, right. We give talks, we make right. artist statements, we put out bad press releases, we do all these, we have art fairs, we have all these reasons for art that we're writing about. It's about charity and therapy and fixing the world and right. healing, all these things. But maybe it's not all the words.
Right.
It just is something else yeah. that exists yeah, outside yeah, yeah. of language.
Yeah, totally.
And maybe that is a problem that art has. Another quote, I can reference this one for sure. It's from a Modest Mouse song. Okay. Or they say, language is the liquid that we're all dissolved in. Great for cleaning up problems after it's created them. So like, right? Like, language goes out into the universe and like fucks a lot of things up for these things that maybe otherwise can exist purely. Because for you to say that you felt art starved and like thirsty,
yeah.
and then you have this experience with an artist in an artwork and suddenly you feel a replenishment.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you have to read his artist statement?
No, 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 totally not. Exactly. No, yeah, no, you're absolutely right. No, I didn't.
I didn't have to go to an opening.
I didn't have to, like, you know, read his resume or, like, you know, like.
Yeah.
Look, I think that it is not surprisingly complicated, right? Like, I think that there's, like I said, the kind of motivating questions for me were, like, why does art matter and how do we engage with it more deeply? Mm-hmm. And I think, not surprisingly, there are many different answers to that question. I hope the book does justice to trying to offer many different answers to those questions. There are some answers that resonated much more with me, mm-hmm. but I think at the same time, like, you see art playing so many different roles in people's lives. Like, it can be an expander of minds. It can be a reorienter of moral compasses. It can be a way to, like, get you that billionaire BFF that you were hoping for, yeah. you know, like, there's, you know, this way in which art is social capital, right? It's like I write about, you know, Du Bourdieu, who's like this, you know, French, one of the only French academics who I can stand, but who talks about how, like, our taste in everything exists not because some things are inherently better than others, but because they mark us as members of a certain social class. And I think that's so much of the dialogue that happens around art, the parties, the press releases. There's mm-hmm. so much signaling that sort of indicates that you are, like, cool and part of the Brooklyn scene, or yeah. you are, you know, powerful and part of the Miami collectors club, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, I think that there's a function and a purpose that art serves in these different contexts, but at the same time, like, to me, I mean, I think that what was most exciting and what really allowed me, I think, to have a kind of breakthrough with art was seeing artists work in their studios mm-hmm. and really understanding how to, I think, savor work more like an artist. And to me, that meant really just being with it, like a yeah. body in space. It was like yeah. paying attention to the physical form, slowing down, yeah. noticing the art decisions that an artist had made in the work.
Yeah.
When I go to galleries and museums, like, I really try not to read the wall text mm-hmm. and just, like, have an experience with the work, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think it's interesting, like, when press releases are so oriented around, like, the philosophies and the isms, mm-hmm. and it's like, we've been told really that what matters about work for the last 100 years is, like, the idea behind it. And yet, when artists talk about their process, it is still a physical thing. It is yeah. athletic. You are wrestling with the laws of nature. Mm-hmm. And so to me, I think trying to tune into those decisions, like, to tune into, like the body in front yeah. of you in the shape of the artwork, in the form of the artwork, is exciting and empowering.
Yeah.
Yeah, the other stuff, there's days and moments for yeah. that other stuff, but you don't mm-hmm. have to,
like,
have it.
Elizabeth Dimon was telling you what
Elizabeth
title.
Denny, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Was saying, like, stay in the work, stay yeah. in the work again and again.
Right, yeah. right, totally. And how many of us really do that?
Yeah.
And it's hard.
It's hard.
It's really, and it's for many reasons, because oftentimes it is uncomfortable. Like, we don't know what's going on, or it feels,
yeah.
I don't know. I mean, artists would always stress about how, like, they wanted to make their work you know, uncomfortable or confusing. And as someone who spends hours of her life refining sentences to try and make them clearer, I was like, why would you want to do that?
Yeah.
And I also feel like thousands of years of evolution have taught me to try to avoid uncomfortable situations. Mm-hmm. But there is a reward and oftentimes a beauty in that discomfort. And yeah, and I just think, you know, there's studies that show that we spend like somewhere between 2 and 17 seconds looking at artworks in museums. Mm-hmm. And I'm no different, right? Like it took, you know, I eventually worked as a security guard, but it basically took, God, like dozens of security cameras and the threat of getting fired to look at something for 40 minutes at a time without taking out my phone or walking away.
Yeah.
So it's hard. But when we stay in it and when we linger and we slow down, mm-hmm. it seems so obvious. But then I think, why don't more of us do it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know. It's so funny. When I was, I don't think I've ever told you this. When I was younger, I went to art school in Norway from the first art school I went to. And I had like an issue with my visa. So I got kicked out of Norway for like a short period. I had to move to England, London, because it was outside of Schengen. And I was so poor because I was not expecting, like, you have 72 hours to leave and go reapply for your visa and wait 3 months. So I had to just move to London and like sleep on friends' couches. It sucked. But I could go to the Tate for free. And so there was a period of my life where I went to the Tate so well and so often that my friends started like thinking it was fun because it was like Cheers to go into the Tate with me. And I'd walk them around and I could tell them about everything that was there. But I'm probably one of the few people in the world, venture to say, besides the people that work there, that like I literally had nothing to do.
And I had money to spend on
no
it.
Money to spend. Right. So I was not trying to go yeah. outside where you like pay for the oxygen in London.
Right, right.
And it would rain and it would be cold and it was weird.
Totally,
and it was
totally.
Like, well, it's warm and it's fine in the Tate,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And I would just walk around and I really got to know a lot of artwork and fall in love with different artists, but it was almost being like forced.
Totally, right.
Forced into a very, I mean, of course, I've lived with many artists and make art myself and lived in artist residencies and different things. So I've had different levels of saturation, but to live with so many people's ideas and voices at once in that way, in this upper crust, like it was chosen for the Tate type of way. Mm. Was a yet another very good like education into that, but I'm sure if I'd had money and you're like, do you want to go to a bar or shopping
right,
or something?
Right,
I would have chosen those other
right.
things.
But it's exciting. I mean, I think that when I was working as a guard, I mean, I felt like I was able to construct my own art history, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, you get to know these artists on like a visceral level, right? Like when someone talks about like Joseph Boy's work, I'm like, I know that. I
yeah.
felt that. I've been there. And I think that that to me at least was, I didn't take art history in college or anything like that. I will confess I've never studied it. So I'm forever, of course, outsider. But
ew.
spray.
But like the... But I tried. I mean, I felt like, I mean, I can't tell you how many books I read just because I felt like I needed that foundation to write
yeah.
my book. And I actually ended up auditing an art history class at Barnard, partially for that reason. And I found it really frustrating. It was just not what I expected. I think I was hoping that this class would really be about looking at the work and it would be about seeing more out of the work. I mean, so much for me of this journey was about like developing visual literacy. It was about like developing an eye. I wanted to not just stare in art's direction, but actually see it, right? Have a conversation mm-hmm. with it. And I guess I was a bit disappointed. I mean, the class was amazing in so many ways, but I was a bit disappointed by the way that it was, the focus was less on art mm-hmm. than on history. And it was so much about like, well, how do we read these as texts that tell us about the history of the time
mm-hmm.
or like the social relations or religious changes? And I guess a part of me felt like, well, I could probably get that from reading a lot of historical books or
yeah.
primary source text documents. And not to say mm-hmm. that a painting is not primary source text in its own way, But nonetheless, it just, it felt like we weren't talking about the work. We were sort of talking about what the work revealed about some other idea. And so I think that that experience of just immersing yourself in it, in a museum, it could be in a gallery, but of course there's something different about immersing yourself with historical work just to kind of understand what people are talking about or what's happened. Mm-hmm. That time, that just like, it's like getting to know a person, right?
Yeah. Do you know this person who makes Instagram videos? Whoa, grandmother. YouTube videos, ContraPoints. Do you know ContraPoints is? Mm. I kind of view them as like a philosopher performance artist. Mm. And check them out, everybody. Do yourself a favor. It's a very fun YouTube dive. But ContraPoints did something about what is that rare air that it is that you breathe in a museum, like trying to figure that out.
It's also literally, I think, like highly filtered air, right?
But I think what she said that I loved was she said something along the lines of it's simultaneously ancient and allegedly, or at least the perception is, it cannot be bought. A masterpiece in a museum, you're never like looking for the price tag. Mm-hmm. So to encounter something potentially, at least I think that is the ultimate pinnacle, right? Of like what a museum is supposed to do. It's elevated and it's risen so high that now it's out of a financial. We know this isn't true. Mm-hmm. We know people have closets of whatever. Right. They're hiding, you know, mummy heads in their closet somewhere. But like, the perception is that when it's in a museum, it's ancient and out of, like, it's not for sale.
Right.
And
right.
For ContraPoints, that was sort of the, oh, that is this rarefied air. Mm. It's something that is true because it has been told for so long that it can't be sold.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, look, but I also think that there's, I don't know. I mean, I think that, yes, we should spend time at the museum. There's an amazing experience to be had there. But also, I think there's something to be gained from spending less time with, like, quote unquote, masterpieces. Mm. You know, like, I think that for me, it's museums are in some ways like encyclopedias of taste, right? It's like these are works that many people at different periods of time could agree on were great. Mm-hmm. And some of them are great and incredible. But they're not all necessarily the best that culture has to offer.
Yeah.
And I think that there's also, I don't know, like there's a scripted nature to museums. Our expectations when we go to museums are a little different. And I think we would all gain a lot by going and getting out of museums a bit more and like seeing unexpected art, like seeing emerging art, seeing art closer to its source. Like, we know that there are flaws in the machine that lead to some works and not others getting elevated to the canon. And while it's hard to fix all of those flaws in the machine overnight, you can begin to start to fix them for yourself by just getting out more, right? And like going to galleries and basements and going to art schools or going beyond art schools or, you know, God forbid, leaving New York City, right?
Art is only made here.
And I just think there's something exciting about, like, you know, yes, like the work is not totally figured out yet. It's experimental. But in some ways, it's like going to a scientist's lab. It's like there's explosions and like anything could happen.
Yeah.
And that's part of the adventure.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I hope you're not sponsored by the Met or something.
Yeah. So.
We would like to be.
Joe, cut. No, not at all. I mean, I feel like I just talked too much about contemporary art and I wanted to support my dead ancestors there for a second.
But they deserve love.
But yeah, I mean, it's so funny. I love listening to you articulate this world greatly, which is why, again,
product placement.
Read the book.
Buy your book.
But I love everything. I love that you're talking about how it's a very indecipherable path. And I appreciate, I'm always grateful for anybody who doesn't view themselves as an artist, though I am convinced you're an artist at this point. Like, who cares? Because, like, why care? Why care about this trash that it's likely a person who has a type of OCD that was doted on too much when they were a child, and we call it art. I'm just kidding. That's what I'm saying about myself. You know, like, what are they, like a child who was tended to too much or whatever? That was neglected. But they, like, you look at these things and you're like, my best friend, he is a chronic trash picker-upper. Mm. I can't even tell you the things he has dragged in and left for me as presents, like a cat leaving like a dead lizard on your bed, where I'm like, I'm fucking mad at you, but whoa, yeah. How did you see that art?
That's amazing.
And yeah. Like he creates these books. He like makes paper out of things that he finds in the world and flowers. And then it's like notes, advertisements, and he creates these, they're like these sculptures, they look like accordions, mm-hmm. and it's like a journey through his mind, and characters repeat, and this is like trash that he finds in texts,
that
and
sounds
I'm like
so cool.
It is literally incredible, but it is a meditation, it is a practice, it is completely real and authentic for him. He chose to never be in the art world, mm. which like let us nod to those people too, if they for some reason are listening to Art Smack, because those people most certainly are valid in who history does decide to crown. I mean, as we know with anything else, land ownership, country formation, whatever, history is told by the rich ones who decide. And that is often what happens with art.
Right.
It's like rich people deciding when something is a masterpiece because they're getting their masterpiece authenticated, you know? But I was talking to someone yesterday on the phone, we're talking about how the economy in the art world needs to be shuffled because art is too expensive and there's too many hungry artists. Mm-hmm. So we need to create a middle and a lower class you know, in tier that is makes it totally acceptable, cool, great, fabulous, wonderful, useful, all the words, all the verbs to buy these things.
Yeah.
And he was like, he's like, I try to tell these artists sometimes. It was Stefan Simkowitz, by the way. But like, he's like, I try to tell these artists, you're pricing your work too much. Like, make that ceramic $1,000 so a lady who's decorating her house can afford to put it on her table for the next 10 years.
Right. Mm-hmm.
If somebody makes something and it lasts for 10 years, that could have very well have been an effective, useful object that came into the art world, into the world of existence.
Totally.
And that would be valid.
Totally.
But instead, it's like it's either going in the landfill or it's $700,000 at Hauser & Wirth, and there is rarely anything in between.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. And I think that happens in a few different ways, right? I mean, I think like I would love to see the process by which people buy art become more transparent and more open. I mean, just, you know, like I think grown up people who are otherwise very capable adults are either don't know how to buy work from galleries or are terrified to do so.
Yeah.
I'm like, why? Why? You know, like, it just doesn't feel necessary. But I think the other piece is, you know, I think that like as viewers, we do need to develop our eye. And like, to me, that means moving away from the emphasis on context. Like, it was very striking to me coming from, you know, I had spent like years training as a sommelier. And like when you are, as part of that, I spent a lot of time blind tasting wine. And when you blind taste a wine, like it's you, it's the glass. And you have to ignore all the things that are designed to play to your sensory biases. Like you can't think about, oh my God, like, you know, it was a Chardonnay last time, it's a Chardonnay again. Or like how much would it cost or whatever. Like you just have to stay true to your own felt experience of something. Yeah. And it was such a trip for me to kind of embark on this journey in the art world and to realize that the art connoisseurs that I was meeting really spent surprisingly little time discussing the merits of the art itself.
Oh, yeah.
And instead they talked about, you know, like, where did this person go to school? Who are they sleeping with? Like, who else showed their work? Who bought it?
What group show? What's the trajectory? Yeah.
Right. And all of that context influenced people's judgment of the work so much more than the physical piece itself. Yeah. And it was just, it was basically, I was being told like, no, like what you think that you are experiencing of the work in your own kind of presence with it is somehow less important than all this other information that I had thought was extraneous. I was like, I probably shouldn't, you know, I shouldn't judge this work based on where they went to grad school. Yeah. That would be wrong, right?
I remember, and this is controversial. So there's like two ways to think about, or two sort of camps. I'm in the second one. I'll say the first one first. No, I'll say the second one first, because I think this is the better way to be. I remember being at a party once, drinking, listening to music with some friends. And I like, my friend just kept playing like good song after good song after good song after good song. But there was no genre.
Mm.
Like we would be listening to like weird pop music from the 90s. And then suddenly we were listening to like music that originated from the Middle East, but it was remixed by a recently deceased DJ in Berlin. Mm. And then we're listening to the Dixie Chicks. Like, I mean, it was all over
right.
the place. Like,
good
it was
songs, just, but just very, yeah. very, an odd mixture.
And I was, and I'm so embarrassed I asked him this. I'm like, but you know, when you're like had a few or you smoke something or whatever, you're like trying to find the connection, you know, or at least I was, and I was in art school at the time. And I was like, Chris, it's like, how did you curate this playlist? You know, because I'm like really reaching. I'm like, this is
looking
amazing.
For, looking to connect the
and
dots.
He, of course, laughed in my face. And he's like, I don't curate my playlist. He was like, I just like the songs that I like.
Hmm.
And then I listen to them. And that list just has grown throughout my life. And that combined with I listened to a New Yorker podcast once. See, this is how I find my advice in life.
This is still one point of
this
view.
This is still one this, point okay. of view. That it was the end of the year, and they were talking about having a guilty pleasure
mm-hmm.
for the year. They were like, one great thing that happened in culture this year and one guilty pleasure that
yeah.
you love.
Right.
And this person, of course, came on and was like, I don't believe in a guilty pleasure.
Right.
You just like something
right.
or you don't like it.
Right.
And when I heard the New Yorker say that it was okay to just like something because I wanted to like it, it really set me fucking free. And guess what? First of all, my Spotify is amazing. So is my art collection. So is the way I eat. So are the friends that I hang right. out with. So are the places that I go to and the people that I mix with.
Right.
Like, that is my life now. But there's a very famous, I would call her out right now, but I can't think of her last name, so I don't want to make her feel bad that I can't remember her name. But one of the most famous curators in the world.
Mm-hmm.
I was interviewing her during the pandemic, and we were talking about the world and what's going on and everything. And I said, you know what? I think after this conversation, we just need to close our laptops and we need to all go and turn on Pixar's Up.
Hmm.
Have a good cry.
Yeah, seriously. Oh my
and
God.
Like feel a little better
yeah.
too.
Right.
And she was like, ugh. I would never watch a Pixar movie. And I was like, what are you talking? Like, I thought because she's a curator,
yeah.
she must be sampling.
Right.
And another way to say this is one of the best chefs in the world literally had the highest rated chef. He had a disease, psychological disease, where he put everything in his mouth.
Mm.
He was a super taster. Mm. Mm-hmm. So he like wanted to know what this tasted like. He
yeah.
wanted to know what this. He wanted to know what that can that sat outside
right.
in the sun for 2 days.
Yeah.
He needed to know what everything tasted like so he could decide how to make the best food in the world.
Right.
Super taster. But this curator was the opposite of an art super taster. Mm-hmm. She was like, oh, no, I cannot. And I'm like, what are you going to watch like a
Law and Order.
Werner, like, no, like a Werner Herzog movie right now. We're in a pandemic, my friend. Put on a fucking Pixar
yeah,
movie.
Yeah, right. Got it.
You know,
yeah,
like,
right.
but it was so interesting, and it is always so interesting to me. Jack Barrett kind of sounded like this as a character, like the opposite of an art super taster, somebody who actually believes in the rules that they've created around themselves for what this whole thing is. And I mean, I guess that's fine because we need people who like really know how to sip Gruner Veltzliners
right.
or
right.
Do you like that wine drop? But like, we need somebody who knows what a Gruner Veltzliner
right.
tastes like.
Right.
But we don't need that many of those people.
Right. Well, but I also think that there's like, I loved, like, Julie Curtis was so inspiring to me in the way, like, you're describing, you know, your friend, for example, that like bring some of these treasures from trash, right? And I do think that artists have this amazing way of viewing the everyday like art, right? It's like this willingness to take this extra beat, to sort of examine a sewage treatment plant like it's a sculpture, right?
Yeah.
To look at it, be like, take an extra beat, sort of look at the form, like wonder at it, just sort of let yourself marvel at sort of impossibility of these things around us. And I think that artists and also scientists like have this similar theory about why art is such an essential part of the human experience. And it is that it helps you know, fight these reducing tendencies of our minds and essentially introduces like dreams, these glitches into our brains. It reminds us that like the world is not as fixed as it should be. It kind of, you know, helps our minds move out of their well-worn pathways and look at the world with this new expansiveness, with these fresh eyes, with this ability to like linger on the chaos and the nuance and the beauty. And I think that part of that means also seeing new things and unexpected things and things you think you might like. Like, you know, Julie had this incredible, like the most omnivorous cultural diet of anyone I'd ever met. You know, it was like one night she was going to the Westminster Dog Show. Another night it was like a, you know, Baroque choral spectacular. Like she could take inspiration from a parked motorcycle on the side of the street, but you know, she also like would lose her mind over like an Van Gogh painting, right? Mm-hmm. And I love the way that she helped me think of taste as not being this fixed thing. Like, I think I'd always thought of taste as like a destination, right?
Yeah.
Like one day I will like the right things, right?
Yeah.
I will know what is the right thing to like. I will know what is good. And I think she helped kind of shake me out of that. And I think she had this sense of like, no, like in some ways, like the worst taste is the taste you can predict every time. Like you always know what someone will like on every, you know, whatever it is, right?
Yeah.
Like automatically no to the Pixar movies, automatically yes to the Herzog. Like
Wait, really fast, what are the right genes in the art world?
The right genes? I mean, look, I think it depends on the season, but like certainly not as tight. I think, you know, it's probably a little baggier and a little shorter, you know?
Okay. So like, because you mentioned that in the beginning, I mean, I have an identity crisis with genes. I don't know what's going on with my gene selection.
Maybe not even gene, maybe be like we may be post-gene, if I'm being totally honest. Like, but no, but I just think that like, you know, taste is a journey, right? Like that is the exciting part. Like we don't have to wear it like an identity. And there was something else I was going to say.
I love that. I know, I like that too.
Right? But we do. I think we tend to, right? We tend to be like, no, I'm a person who likes, I don't know, like country music. I'm a person who likes impressionism. I'm a person that hates impressionism. And like nothing can shake you loose from that, right?
Yeah.
And it feels scary. And I will admit that part of this whole adventure for me was disorienting. I really felt like I had this identity crisis when it came to matters of taste. I think we often spend a lot of time talking about the significance of things.
Yeah.
And we could stand to spend more time talking about our love for things. Mm-hmm. You know, rather than like, why is this important or what does this represent? It's like, why do you love it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it great to you? And I just feel like when it comes to a lot of art forms, that's sort of a conversation that's fallen out of favor. Mm-hmm. But I think it's a really productive one to have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, why? Like, what got you excited about? I mean, you can't see it. Like, what got you excited about that? You know what I mean?
Oh, she can tell you.
Right.
If there's one person who can tell you why they're excited about their art, it's Annie. I love that about you.
I get very into the artists that I collect. That one in particular, this is Francoise Gillot. She was one of Picasso's muses. But why I like this piece so much is because it reminds me of a
Manet
called The Balcony, where he paints Bertha Morisot like staring off to the right of the canvas, and you're like always trying to meet her gaze, but she'll never look at you. And you're like, what are you thinking about? What are you looking at? What is so captivating to you? And this line drawing by Francoise Gillot, it evokes that same feeling to me. So
wow. See, guys, that is how you appreciate art. There's no other way. Case closed. No, go here, make your bed or brush your teeth. So, like, what would you, if you could say, like, art, like, is it here to stay in your life?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So totally. You're not breaking up with art.
No.
What would you say, like, knowing what you know now, like, if you could meet your self that never wrote the book or didn't write the book yet, and you, like, what are the three big exchanges from the book? Like, what can you leave and what would you take? Like, where are you the same or if not even more reinforced, and where are you totally on a different spectrum now?
I mean, I think, how have I changed the course's process?
Yeah, or like, if you had to leave certain thoughts or ideas behind, or maybe you found new thoughts or ideas that you didn't have before, what are those?
Yeah, I mean, I think the big one is that I think that art is essential, you know, and that was not, that was certainly not how I felt at the outset. I mean, I felt like it was a luxury in so many different ways. I think it not only kind of appeared to be a luxury just by nature of the high prices and everything you read about it from the arts outside and the kind of imposing, rarefied air of art spaces, but also just because I was like, okay, this can't like feed you, house you, or be used to kill predators. Mm-hmm. Like, this is a luxury. And I think it's not. I mean, I really think that it is, in a sense, I think artists have shown this to me, and I think scientists have also shown this to me, this way in which it is, again, fundamental to the human experience, that it is, you know, it is a universal impulse. It is something that, like, we have needed as a species, mm-hmm. like, forever.
Yeah.
And I think that that is partially what really frustrates me about some of the these deliberately erected barriers to entry and the sort of strategic snobbery that predominates in so many corners of the art world, is it feels like we're sort of cutting people off from a key part of their humanity.
Mm-hmm. So leave the snobbery.
Leave the snobbery, yeah. And I think, what is in the, like, those lists are like, snobbery out. Like,
Kindness.
Oh, God. It's like a Girl Scout.
Oh, my God. Are we, I just don't want to give away too much of the book, but I love that. What do you say? At one point, you say, like, the rule is, like, you're not allowed to call a painting beautiful.
Oh, right. I felt that way. I don't know. I know you've mentioned things, called things beautiful in a positive way, I think, on the podcast. But, yeah, I felt like I realized too late that I had, like, was apparently insulting everyone, you know?
No, there's a very interesting theory about that I wanted to share with you.
Yeah, please.
So I was at an artist talk 12 years ago. I can't even, like, an artist said this, I did not invent this, but I'm regurgitating it. And they were talking about beauty. And they were talking, because especially, like, if you looked at paintings 12 years ago, it was particularly out of the zeitgeist to make beautiful paintings.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Zombie formalism was around, like, whatever. It was not a beautiful moment. And this person, who was a man, I remember it was a man saying this because I was impressed, but he said, I think that your hang-up against beauty by going around pointing at things that are decorative or, you know, these things that are around us to elevate our experience going through the world and not make everything feel so bleak all the time. He's like, it reads as very misogynistic to me.
Interesting.
That you would be so afraid of things that are deemed beautiful because there is that link to, like, decorative, to the trompe-l'oeil, to the unnecessary. Mm. And ever since I heard him say that, because trust me, I posed as an art hipster once, like in my 20s in San Francisco, and it didn't last very long for me. But I remember, you know, going through periods where I followed all of the isms and art history and art theory to their ultimate point, which was, nothing could be beautiful and everything had to have some critical edge and must, like, convey some
angst.
Deep, harsh meaning about the reality of life. And that a lot of that, and it, when you look at a lot of modernism, which is often associated with maleness, you know, hard-shaped lines, very minimal use often, sparse use of color. It's not there to be decorative. It's there to express the angst of World War II and the bomb.
Right.
You know, like, and if someone were over in the corner painting a beautiful flower, like one was somehow not the same. And because it tended to be like the woman that was in the corner interpreting this through a rose that was losing its petal, you know, versus the man who's painting in black with a mop, you know?
Right.
Hers was not good enough.
Right.
And I mean, I'm not here to push any agenda or push the gender war any further in this country or in this world, but sometimes I do feel like there is a bias where when something is aesthetically pleasing and intended to be so, it is written off as trompe-l'oeil, decorative, of the feminine regal, as opposed to being something that is really smart.
Yeah.
Right.
Ooh.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think also, I at least have, I feel like the disdain for beauty is really nihilistic. I mean, I think that the argument that's misogynist is really interesting too, but I think also fundamentally it's nihilistic. It's like, and I think for me, I came to sort of think of beauty as, look, it doesn't have to be the visual equivalent of a vanilla cupcake, right? Like it doesn't have to be a sunset.
Yeah.
It also doesn't have to be, even have necessarily a physical form. I mean, people talk about like finding math equations beautiful, right? Or like physics theories. But I think beauty for me is something that just pulls you deeper into life, right? It's this thing that pulls you toward it.
Yeah.
It like sparks your curiosity. You want to be near it. You want to engage with it. It has this attractive quality. It doesn't have to be attractive and like always necessarily like the kind of conventional sense, but it's like, I think beauty is this like excited hell yes to life. It's like, what's going on here? Like, I want to just be with
here.
It.
Yes, I'm here. I want to appreciate this. Live in it. Bianca. It was so nice to hear this. Oh, God.
But I also think that the exciting thing about art is the way that it can open us up to seeing beauty in more places.
Yeah.
Like, I think when you talk to artists, I mean, they do recognize beauty in the trash or in, you know, like, I don't know, like the hot dog cart or whatever it is, right? It's like these things that, and I think that that is maybe some of that where we find a compromise between like, oh my God, this work is uncomfortable or something. And, you know, like, well, maybe there are moments where even that uncomfortable work that is like grotesque or weird is beautiful. Like there's this, you know, the Paul Cadmus Seven Deadly Sins series at the Met that's like, I mean, kind of utterly grotesque in some ways, but like, I always like just pull towards it. And I think there's a beauty in it too. Yeah. I mean, we're talking like pustules and like shit. I mean, it's a mess, this series, but.
I want to hear about like, what direction are you bringing your collection? If you have one, if that's something you're working towards.
Yeah, I don't, you know, I think it wasn't something I was doing while I was like doing research. I mean, in part because just the, you know, it sort of, we look at like the code of conduct for like the publications that I write about. I tried to apply that in sort of the sense of like, you know, you're not, for example, you're not writing about a company that you own stock in, right? Or like, and of course, you know, none of us would demean art by saying it's like owning stock in a company, but it has financial value, right? Like, so that's not to say like, you know, I felt like I was constantly coming across pieces that I just wanted to like take home and live with and like wake up to that surprise that they offered every day. And I also, I think as part of that, you know, as a side note, made me really skeptical of this myth of false scarcity that I think the art market peddles, right? There's this idea 100%. Like if you don't buy it now, you have missed out on this once in a lifetime chance to own the Mona Lisa.
Yeah.
And like, I don't believe that genius is in short supply. I do think that there's perhaps we could stand for some more independent thinking, you know?
Okay, let's play a game. Yes, I agree. What if you could own one artwork in the world? You have to be trapped with it in a white room for the rest of your life.
For the rest of my life, what just as art. Oh my God! Wow. What would you guys say?
I already know. The Art of Painting by Vermeer.
That was so fast. Show it to me right now. I want to see it. Should even think about it. I know what mine is too.
I just
Mine?
Yeah.
Well, mine could be a couple things, but probably I wouldn't. I could go really crazy and stare at like a Peter Paul Rubens painting just forever, like a big one with like lots of baby angels and rape and horses and whatever going on, and just kind of,
interesting. Okay.
But I think it would be a Helma off Klimt.
That's interesting. I like that. I mean, I think strategically, like having a painting with people in it sort of makes sense if you're going to be alone with in a white room.
You're never alone if you're on your own.
Hello. So I think that like there's sort of three works that come to mind, and I'm having trouble deciding between them. One is an utterly disturbing and insane painting by the artist Iwo Kagoshima that's like...
Picture.
It's going to take me a second to find it, probably. I saw it in Mitchell August's gallery, and it's stuck with me. It's like...
Don't look at my Google history.
or do. And tell me what it is.
Take me a second to find it. It's like... Oh, it's...
Is Jerry Gagosian art?
Yeah, is Jerry Gagosian famous? Okay, while you're looking.
Oh, here it is.
Oh, you found it?
Yeah.
Ooh.
Cool. Yeah, it's weird, man. It's just weird. But I feel like that'd be good company.
Is her breast leaking? I love that.
And then on the other opposite end spectrum, so while I was working as a guard at the Guggenheim, I fell in love with... Really cool. Brancusi's Miracle Seal, which is, you know, this sort of like looks like a toothpaste dollop of white marble, and it's just incredible. And like, you know, I just wanted to like,
Interesting.
Really?
Yeah. Joe, you should flash some photos of
really?
These artwork.
Yeah. I mean, okay. But also, they're so dildo with it.
Yeah, I'm interested with this taste.
Because then I would get to actually like touch it. Look at it. But
if it's
like,
in your home,
it's
you get to
like,
do whatever you want with it.
Yeah, you can do anything you want with this artwork, let's be clear. Yeah. Basically what I'm saying is you're trapped in an insane asylum with one artwork for the rest of your life.
I think it would be great company. Mm-hmm. Okay. I think it might help me regain sanity too.
Okay.
Yeah. That's fair.
I mean, it just would change its moods constantly. And like, so this was a piece in particular where I would stand in front of the wall label because I just felt like the wall label so cut off people's interpretations of the work. You know, they would come and they would glance at that little, you know, tombstone and be like, oh, miracle, parentheses, seal. It's a seal.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, man, I've spent weeks with this. Like, it's a foot. It's a slug. It's toothpaste. It's a person giving birth. Like, and when people would stop and really wrestle with it and spend time with it, it just, there was no limit to what they would discover. And its mood would change. Like, one day it was like trying to slink off for the window and make an escape. Like, another day it looked like it had like hoovered up a French tourist. Like, another day, like, it had gotten in a fight. Like, I finally noticed that there's this like, you know, gray modeling to the marble. And I was like, oh my God, like, it looks bruised, you know? And it just changed.
Do you know what you sound like right now? No,
she's totally drinking.
A lot of context. I'm listening to a podcast right now about this girl who was haunted by a doll that she was given when she was a child.
Oh, wow.
And she was like, no matter how I would move it, its eyes always looked like it was on me. Mm-hmm. Like, it would seem to move sometimes. Yeah. Like, sometimes a noise would happen and I couldn't explain it. Or, like, for some reason, when the light would hit it this way, it looked particularly hateful. Like, maybe it is that obsession to obsessed like you're talking about, and I'm not calling art haunted dolls, but there might be some
maybe just the good ones. Maybe that's the definition of quality. It's like the way you talk about this work sounds sort of like a haunted doll, you know? Like, it's,
definitely has something over me.
Yeah,
I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
I could talk to you about this forever because clearly this is like, I don't know at this point, and I always say this, like, I don't know when I chose art and when art chose me, because I feel like I've lost control. Mm. Like, that's why at the beginning of this, I was like, so you wrote the book. Do you get to walk away from this?
No,
are you recovering? Or is this, like, here
is
with you forever?
I hope it is. I think it is. I mean, I think that, you know, I think it is in the sense that I don't feel like it's exhaustible, right? Exhaustive?
Yeah.
Exhaustible, is that the word? You know, it's just, And God, isn't that exciting? It's like, yeah, there'll always be more art to discover. There's always new art. Like, there's new relationships to have with the work. That Iwao Kagoshima painting is a great example where, like, the first time I saw it very early in my journey into the art world, I saw it and I was like, this is insane. Like, who would ever want to spend time with this?
To live
with this. Yes. Yeah. And now I'm like, lock me in a room forever. Yeah. Like, it's, and that was a real, like, I didn't see that coming. And you know, people talked a lot, I kept talking about this artist, and I was like, I don't know, this seems like a little, you know, okay, whatever. And like, I'm totally there. And that's cool too, right? That, like, there's pieces that you might dismiss and then fall head over heels with a few months or a few years later.
Have you had anything where you've seen something, even like in an art show, art fair? She used to work in art fairs, so she used to see a lot of art in fast gulps, where, like, something that came in that one of those doses that sits with you where you're like, I could really see that thing again. I would love to see that. If I could ever see that one thing again, I would love to.
I didn't get much of that at
Shady.
We can bleep that. Or not.
Or not.
But I definitely feel that way when I walked, when I walk through Freeze. And I know that's probably an answer a lot of people would give. But I think that the works that the galleries bring there have such a presence. And there's one in particular that I will find from Freeze, New York last year. I can't remember the artist's name, but it was just so incredible that it has stayed with me, and I can see the exact piece in my mind, even though I can't remember who it is or what the gallery was, but I will find it for the both of you.
I feel like that, yeah, I'm thinking this, like, marble peach that I saw once.
Oh, I think it was at the Independent.
It was, yeah, probably. And it was at M&B, because I think M&B showed it, maybe. It was like
it was a British artist, British gallery?
No.
Okay.
Benjamin Trigano, because he listens. He showed it, and I think it was like 2015. Oh, it was their summer group show at M&B Gallery. I don't even know who the artist was. It was this stone. It was like a giant peach. And I think about that thing sometimes. And and artists, like, this is what's so amazing. It's like we lose control at a certain point of what we've made and what people in turn do with the things that have been made. And I mean, I guess that's why you have to really kind of hopefully mean what you say and mean what you make, because, or not, but, like, these things will go out into the world and, like, be oddly impactful, where, like, we're asking each other these questions and I'm like, I wonder who bought that. Yeah. I hope whoever bought that peach didn't just put it in storage.
Right, right.
I hope they are enjoying that peach. Yeah.
But did you know it at the moment? Like, I think, like, my answer to that question would be a pile of dirty snow I saw at Night Gallery at the Independent a couple of years ago. And at the time, I was like, this is absurd. And now, I literally, like looked it up, and I was like, I wonder what happened. Like, I really would love to have that pile of dirty snow. Like, fuck, that would be so cool.
Yes.
Anyway, I think it's long gone, but it stuck with me. It's that it is in my head. It's like the memory is still with me.
Okay, so she has drunk the Kool-Aid, and she's totally drunk the Kool-Aid. You're never going anywhere. You are ours now. We are your haunted dolls. Yeah.
She's welcome in this family.
No, this is really great. I'm gonna again encourage everybody to check out Bianca's book. It's just as much fun listening to her speak as it is to read the book. And you're welcome back anytime.
Thank you. That's so kind of you. Thank you.
This is so much fun.
Yeah. God, the first time, you know, the second time ever, I feel like I belong. Wow, it's really, like,
if you love art, if anybody who loves art to the extent that you do, because I go in and out. Like I said, sometimes I'm very grateful that anyone cares. But then I'm like, of course there's levels and there's ways that people love and appreciate art. And I was with someone recently who was only the type of person that cares about how much something costs. But it felt like it could be a piece of clothing.
Right.
You know,
right.
Like, it only mattered. Like, it would only turn their head truly.
Right.
If, like, they heard it was worth a lot of money.
Yeah. Right.
And when I identified that in them to be genuinely part of their personality and they were just being them.
Yeah.
Like this person was being comfortable enough to be around me to show me this was her relationship to art. I was like, you are not welcome in my family. And like, damn, I don't know if we can be friends.
Mm, yeah.
Because no.
Right.
I mean, stuff that is expensive is cool, but also no.
Right.
Mm-hmm. None of that shit matters.
Mm,
yeah. Mm-mm.
It doesn't matter. It's not going to get you through the panda, you know.
It's not going to get you through your white room. I don't know.
Exactly. Anyway, thank you so much for writing the book.
That's really, so kind of you to say.
Really great.
Thank you. Thank you so much for the kind words. Thank you for reading it, which means so much to me. And thank you for having me on.
And if you're too lazy to read it, like Annie was, you can listen to it on Audible.
I call that great at multitasking for a busy working woman who has multiple jobs.
You're right. Because you're the only one that works here.
I don't know if you
know
that.
So you can listen to it either any other way.
Yeah.
And final question, do you know what you're going to do next, or are you on a vacation?
I don't know. And I'm not on a vacation. I don't know what I'm going to do next, but more than excited to brainstorm if you guys want to talk about it. Yeah.
All right, cool. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you
for turning in to episode 3 of Art Smack, and thank you, Bianca. We loved having you on.
Thank you.
And a way for you guys to support us, support Jerry, support myself, is to follow us, give us 5 stars, and leave us a review on whatever platform you're
listening to.
A good review.
And if you don't know what that is, ask ChatGPT.
They will help you. Mm-hmm. All right, thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the internet.
See you on the internet.
Bye.
Art Smack is produced, edited, and mixed by Joe Tisdall. Thank you, Joe. We love you. A quick note from our sponsor, Aetna Fine Art Logistics, the preferred shipping partner of Art Smack and Jerry. From shipping to storage and a specialty in art fair operations, Aetna provides a seamless one-stop shop for all your fine art logistics needs. They are also facilitating shipping and art handling for all the spring shows in New York. So if you need any logistical assistance, please feel free to email me at annie.taylor@aetnafineart.com.